Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. Each week we ask a few of our writers to read their pieces out aloud. On this episode, Emma Thompson talks about the Church of England and how its cuts are about to devastate the parish network, a tragedy, she says, for communities across the country, religious or not. Then we've got Matt Ridley reading his piece about the evolution of viruses and why lockdown might have an effect in turning them in a rather nasty direction. And finally, Toby Young asking where his peerage is. And yes, he's serious. First up, Emma Thompson.
A clergyman admitted to me that he'd recently burst into tears. He received an email from his diocese in this latest lockdown, strongly urging vicars to close their churches. He has an elderly working-class congregation in a poor area. Coming to church was the one thing keeping them going. Local vicars like him represent the best of the Church of England. They are loving, kind, and they know their flock. Before the pandemic, the C of E had seen attendance halve in a generation. Weekly religious attendance is highest among non-Christian faiths, 40%, followed by Roman Catholics, 23%, and all other Christian denominations, 23%. Anglicans are much less likely to attend weekly, 9%, or at all. 57% say they go to church never or practically never. Yet that gap between the number identifying as C of E and actual attendance presents an opportunity. It shows an untapped interest in preserving our national church. When COVID struck and those people turned to their churches for spiritual consolation, what did they find? Closed doors. The Anglican Church should have been at the forefront of the pandemic response. But the leadership's reaction has been supine, and the C of E now faces an existential crisis. In pre-COVID times, parish giving totaled £1.1 billion, the vast majority of the church's revenue. Lockdown dealt a hammer blow to the finances. After a service on Zoom, there is no collection plate to pass around. The shortfall in parish giving means cuts must be made to the parishes, or so the argument goes. But who was it who pushed to close the churches, making collections and fundraising impossible? While Justin Welby was zooming from his kitchen on Easter Sunday, many vicars and parishioners felt let down. Even committed churchgoers like me feel almost ready to walk away. In November, cuts were announced in Chelmsford Diocese, making 61 parish clergy posts redundant. The plan is to apply similar cuts around the country. As the country faces recession, the Church of England should be rallying to help sad legions of newly unemployed, not adding its own vicars to the dole queue. Cuts will be devastating for both the clergy and the communities they serve. A leaked paper from the Archbishop of York envisages that out of every 5 Anglicans who attended church pre-lockdown, only 4 can be expected to return. This is the ratio Chelmsford is working to. Donations are expected to be down by 20% this year. Clerical jobs in Chelmsford have been graded in traffic light tiers to signal how likely they are for the chop. Parishes in green are expected to have enough of a congregation left to pay for a full-time priest plus diocesan costs. Another 82 jobs are amber, on the edge. Vacancies there are likely to be filled by fixed-term interim clergy, allowing time to reassess their sustainability. Finally, 45 jobs are red, meaning the congregation needs to consider other possibilities for leadership, such as service by House for Duty clergy and licensed lay ministers. Some Chelmsford clergy feel depressed, even suicidal. For the first time in my long ministry, I feel demoralised and unwanted, one tells me. I left my former career to serve God and his church. I did not expect this, said another. Tellingly, they feel too afraid to speak out except anonymously. As a parish church volunteer for 25 years, I squirm to witness a culture of fear in a Christian organisation. The church is not a financial business. Other factors should be considered, and management systems should be a positive way of rewarding the good. Chelmsford's is extremely negative. It implies that a good vicar is one who brings in enough money, who prioritises rich over poor. It is tragic to see clergy being discarded when we need them most. We all understand the need to retrench, but in a well-managed business, a belt-tightening review should encompass the entire payroll. Chelmsford's grading system applies only to parish clergy, not diocesan employees. It has just advertised for a CEO at a salary of £85,000 to £90,000. Compare this with a vicar's £27,000 stipend. Moreover, a second wave of cuts is threatened, with 49 more posts to go by 2026 if giving levels do not increase. With extraordinarily crass timing, Chelmsford has launched a giving campaign under the slogan, Generous God, Generous Disciples. Am I feeling generous? No. My rector is already stretched over 7 villages and 5 churches. The hierarchy's lack of recognition that clergy are catalysts for giving seems bizarre. The most important people in the church are the laity, the ones for whom we exist. Seeing such a cold, managerial strategy is unlikely to invoke generosity as a Christian devotional response, says Canon Paul Hamilton, the Chelmsford vicar whose church was showered with £22,000 in donations within days of being damaged by an illegal rave last month. The laity, who cares about the volunteers who clean the church, teach Sunday school, organise the flower rota, raise yet more funds to replace the roof? In the autumn, the Archbishops of Canterbury and York held focus groups to consult on the future direction of the C of E. In a snub to their parishes, they consulted young people, including primary school children, instead of existing donors. This month, the C of E's elected governing body, the General Synod, will hear the Archbishop of York's plans to impose a management system on its parishes around the country, rolling out Chelmsford-style cuts on parish clergy and selling assets owned by the parishes to fund yet more managers. Retained parish clergy would be stretched over larger areas in a managerial role. This would effectively end the C of E as we know it, converting a precious network of parish churches into a remote institution which controls everything centrally. The church had problems before lockdown, but with more people working from home, there is a trend towards localisation. The church commissioners could use some of the church's investment income to regenerate the parishes. If allowed to keep more of their own money, freed from endless fundraising to pay diocesan bills, and liberated from the struggle with bureaucracy, parish clergy and volunteers might be able to take advantage of a mood of post-pandemic renewal. Instead, we face a policy of withdrawal, embarked upon in haste behind closed doors. As the Reverend James Rodley asked in a letter to the Church Times, how can it be right to use the Church's inherited assets, the gifts of past generations, to pay lawyers and HR managers to make vicars redundant? Another proposal is that parishes rely on lay readers, self-supporting priests and retired clergy. This reflects a fundamental failure to recognise the nature of volunteering. Increasingly, retired clergy are not applying for permission to officiate because of the strangulating bureaucracy. Volunteers' time and donations, freely given, can be freely withdrawn. Unlike parish clergy, who inspire giving, new management posts can only be funded, ultimately, by increasing diocesan bills to the parishes. This puts pressure on volunteers and makes it harder to fundraise. One local bishop behaved like a loan shark on Zoom, berating volunteers for having run out of money, reducing a treasurer to tears. The bishops won't listen. They love their corporate existence, says one church observer. They want online worship live from the Church of England Central. Bad luck if you're elderly or poor and don't have internet. The plan to dismantle the parish network is quite simply the biggest act of church vandalism since the dissolution of the monasteries. It comes at precisely the moment when communities need the comfort and assistance of leaders on the ground. Parishes have been kicked almost to death, then woken up and told to pay up, says one vicar. Will it take a nationwide parish giving strike before church leaders will listen?
That was Emma Thompson, now Matt Ridley.
In the genetic diaspora of an epidemic, there is ferocious competition between strains of virus to get into the next victim first. That leads to apparently purposeful outcomes, as if the virus had a mind. One of the things people find hardest to grasp about evolution is that it appears purposeful, but the mutations on which it feeds are random. How come dolphins evolved to swim if all they had to work with were random changes in genes? Viruses also mutate at random, but most people talk as though the rise and fall of these mutant versions is mainly down to chance or luck. It's not. Mutations occur all the time in RNA viruses. What matters is which ones find favour in natural selection. The champions of Darwinian medicine have been calling for their colleagues to take evolution and adaptation more into account for years, and one of them, Paul Ewald of the University of Louisville, has something very relevant to say about this pandemic. Years ago, Ewald came up with a theory of why some diseases are lethal and others are mild. He argues it is all about the mode of transmission. Infections that you catch from coughs and sneezes are mostly mild. We get more than 200 different kinds of common cold virus, and on the whole, none of them puts you in bed, let alone kills you. Yet insect-borne diseases, such as malaria, plague and yellow fever, and waterborne diseases such as cholera and typhoid, seem quite content to kill you. The reason, says Ewald, is that in direct contact diseases such as colds, mild strains will do better than nasty ones because they send you out to work and to parties coughing and sneezing. Insect-borne or waterborne diseases, meanwhile, may actually spread better if they confine you delirious to a deathbed with a high pathogen load, the better to attract mosquitoes or, sorry, maximise your contribution to local sewers. There are two other categories of transmission. Sexually transmitted diseases such as syphilis, herpes and AIDS, which may or may not kill you in the end, but are good at lurking hidden so you have a chance to move to a new partner. And durable sit-and-wait diseases such as tuberculosis and, to some extent, smallpox, caught from surfaces which can afford to be lethal because they can be passed on after you're dead. Every virus uses mutation and selection to find a compromise between maximising its offspring while killing the host or moderating its effect and keeping the host active. Yet there was always one epidemic that didn't seem to fit Ewald's theory, the 1918 flu, which grew more deadly in the second wave despite being spread by coughs and sneezes. In 2011, Ewald had a crack at explaining this exception in a way that neatly tests the rule. See if you find it convincing. The 1918 flu was first noticed in US Army training camps in Kansas in early March. Throughout the spring and summer, it was about as lethal as most flus, dangerous to the very young and very old, but mild in everybody else. It was in August, on the Western Front, that Army doctors started noticing that the flu was turning deadly, regularly killing fit young adults. Influenza increasing and becoming more fatal, wrote a senior US Army surgeon in his diary on 17th of August. Ewald thinks that this was because lethal strains were spreading better than mild ones. Imagine that a mild case would be sent to a dugout to sleep it off, while a severe case was put on a stretcher and taken down the line to a series of crowded field stations, trains and hospitals. The sicker a soldier was, the more he was moved and the more nurses and doctors he saw. The peculiar conditions of the trenches allowed individuals immobilised by illness to be transported repeatedly from one cluster of susceptible hosts to another in trenches, tents, hospitals and trains, Ewald argued. The flu was essentially being spread by attendants, a bit like malaria is spread by mosquitoes. The deadly strains were now at an advantage. This explains why subsequent flu epidemics have never been as nasty, and, predicted Ewald, never will be. There is a worrying parallel with COVID-19. In the early wave, a lot of cases were spread by attendants in hospitals and care homes. One South African hospital traced how a single outpatient seeded an epidemic that spread from ward to ward, infecting 39 patients and 80 staff. The virus had a means to get from victim to victim, even if they stayed put. It was attendant-borne, like the 1918 flu. Did that encourage the virus to be more lethal? An estimate published this week by Public Health England finds that the B117 Kent mutant is roughly 65% more fatal than previous strains. By contrast, because of lockdown, a mild case of COVID kept you isolated at home. Last week, the Financial Times carried an article about the huge but surprisingly mild epidemic of COVID that India is suffering. It quoted one doctor as saying that we are seeing a lot less severe diseases than the rest of the world and a lot more asymptomatic infections. And another that it's pretty generally accepted that in India we have a very mild form of the virus. There are lots of possible explanations, but because lockdowns have been mostly ineffective in India, could it be that mild variants have done well and an attendant-borne evolution to greater virulence has not happened? Yet for every Mumbai there is a Manaus, a city in Brazil that had a huge first wave with little or no lockdown and saw a lot of people die. Some thought Manaus had reached the herd immunity threshold, but it now is seeing a bad second wave. Remember, however, that the deadly strain of 1918 flu started in the trenches, but soon spread everywhere. It's the global average strategy that we use against the virus that counts, not the local one. Manaus's new strain seemed to have arrived in the city from elsewhere. You might conclude from this logic that we have made a mistake by locking down, ensuring that the virus remains deadly or becomes more so. I hesitate to agree with that because I've been wrong about a lot during this pandemic. And there is one crucial way in which COVID-19 differs from flu. It spares the young and clobbers the old. That might be enough to ensure that nasty strains remain competitive with mild ones, even in the absence of lockdowns. A strain that causes only very mild symptoms in most people, so they go out spreading it, but occasionally kills the vulnerable, might thrive. I don't know if Britain would have seen more than 100,000 deaths, or fewer, if we had pursued a less draconian strategy, like India, Sweden, or Florida. But I do know that evolution is about more than mutation.
That was Matt Ridley, and finally, Toby Young.
Watching Lord Hannon of Kingsclear being introduced in the House of Lords on Monday was a bittersweet moment. On the one hand, I'm delighted for Dan. He's one of the heroes of Brexit, and his impromptu speech about Margaret Thatcher in the pub following her memorial service brought a tear to my eye. You can find his speech on YouTube. But on the other, I can't help thinking, where's my bloody peerage? I've edited this and that, co-founded 4 free schools, served on the boards of numerous charities, and set up the Free Speech Union. I was the chief exec of a high-profile charity, for Christ's sake, and my immediate predecessor got a CBE. I haven't even got a lousy MBE. All the more surprising, given that I must be one of the few potential recipients who wouldn't denounce the British Empire as soon as he pocketed the gong. I thought my elevation to the Lords might happen when Boris became Prime Minister. Up until that point, I'd given him more tobacco enemas than any other journalist in Fleet Street. Blown smoke up his arse. I even wrote a 5,000-word hagiography for an Australian magazine entitled Cometh the Hour, Cometh the Man. Indeed, I laid on the oil so thick in that piece, I'm now worried that when I'm standing in front of St. Peter at the pearly gates, he's going to bring it up. You did plenty of good works, you've been a decent husband and father, and you always gave money to beggars. But on the other hand, you did write that 5,000-word piece about Boris in which you compared him to Nietzsche's Übermensch. Sorry, mate. It's down you go. It was Boris who got my hopes up. In September of 2011, when he was Mayor of London, he opened the first free school I helped set up. He made quite a good joke as he cut the ribbon.
The Secretary of State for Education has given a new word to the English language, he said, referring to our mutual friend. We give, they gave, he gove us this school.
Afterwards, as he was getting into his chauffeur-driven car, he asked me if I'd like to be in the House of Lords.
We need more people like you, he said.
Don't I have to give £1 million to the Tory party first?
Leave it with me, he said, touching his nose.
I can't say I'm particularly enamoured by the ermine, or even the £305 daily attendance allowance. No, the big attraction of the upper house is that it would force Caroline to take my name. When we got married, she said she'd never change her name, but I persuaded her to make one exception. If I became a lord, she'd become Lady Young. She agreed to this because she thought it would never happen, whereas I congratulated myself on having pulled a fast one. 20 years later, she's proving to be a better fortune teller than me. Given how critical I've been of Boris since the outbreak of the coronavirus crisis, I've now abandoned all hope. Bloody typical of me. I've been a massive Boris backer since I campaigned for him to become president of the Oxford Union in 1985. Then, 35 years later, when he's finally in a position to reward his loyal supporters, I start attacking him in the press. It was the same story with David Cameron. We were at Brasenose together, and when he was still Prime Minister, I told him about the shock I'd received when I returned for a college reunion and Dave Ramsden, a contemporary of ours and now Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, let slip he'd been given a knighthood. Come on, Prime Minister, I said. You've got to stick me in the Lords so I can one-up him at the next Brasenose Gordy. He laughed, but I told him I was in deadly earnest. I thought there might be a sliver of a chance until we ended up on different sides during the EU referendum. Another bridge burnt. I realised the prospect of me becoming Lord Young of Acton is about as likely as Katie Hopkins being made a dame. But whenever a new list of honours comes out, I cannot help running my eye down it and thinking, why has that oxygen thief been given that? He's achieved nothing compared with me. It's one of the many unpleasant things about growing old, the furious sense of injustice whenever one of your peers is recognised for their achievements. My best hope is to ingratiate myself with Boris's successor, whoever that might be. But knowing me, I'd just pick a fight with him as soon as he set foot in number 10.
That was Toby Young, and that's it for this week's episode of Spectator Out Loud. And a reminder, if you enjoy our podcasts and would like to join the Spectator's broadcast team, you've just under a week to get your application in. We love podcasts, love audio, and we're looking to do a lot more. Go to spectator.co.uk/producer to find out more. And in general, if you have any feedback about our podcast, then do email us at podcast@spectator.co.uk. We always love to hear from you, and we read every single email. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our producer, Max Jeffrey.